Hey, welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Ready for another show. Hey, hello, and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 95. Today is November 12th, 2008. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This show contends that 9/11 is Canada's single most important issue because the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our sovereign nationhood, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the real motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offers further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either omitted or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Our ignore it and maybe it will go away on its own mentality is killing us. It has to end now. It is high time to wake up and to educate, to learn, to work together, and to find the courage to act on our love for one another. Our every freedom is at stake in this battle for truth and accountability. The prize is nothing less than the health of our collective human soul. The revolution has begun. Find your role. Thank you, Bruce Coburn. That is Action Speak Louder. Right now we're listening to DJ Shadow. That'll be followed by Ashley McIsaac. So what do I have for you today at show number 95? Well, I have an interview with Jack East. Now, Jack East was a candidate in the recent federal election with the Marxist-Leninist Party. And this was his second election. 06 was his first, and now 08. And both times he represented the Nanaimo-Cowichan riding. And I went to the all-candidates meeting a short while back, and I asked a 9/11 question, if any of the parties would be willing to, or persons or parties, would be willing to call for a Canadian independent investigation into 9/11, you know, in hopes that, well, finally our government and media will see what a big fat lie this whole 9/11 is. And get our troops out of Afghanistan, erase a lot of the deals that the conservatives and liberals have done, the shadow deals, you know, the SPP, things like that. Jack, he's not only was he all over the 9/11 question, he mentioned two topics that none of the other candidates are, well, they're not allowed to talk about these things. One being American Empire, and then secondly, the evil gangster banksters and the influence of international money. So, well done, Jack East. I'll be telling you a little bit more about Jack. I believe he's in Campbell River right now. It's going to be a telephone interview. Also tonight, David Ray Griffin has a new book. It is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up, and The Exposé. All of Branch Press produced this, as they have for most of his books. And I'm going to be reading from the preface of that. And Dr. David Ray Griffin is my favorite author of the 9/11 Truth Movement. He's one hell of a researcher, and he very solid. So I guess I could say that his 2004 book, The New Pearl Harbor, very quickly kind of became the the main book to go to. He, you know, put together the research that had been conducted at that point, put it together into the new Pearl Harbor. So now 4 years later, there's a lot more information is out. So he's put out a companion piece, which he's calling Revisited. So there we are. Moving on to some audio pieces we're going to hear tonight. This is the Complete Idiot's Guide to the New World Order. We're going to be hearing that in the second half of the show. And it is a collection of many of the key audio clips that, you know, you see and listen to on YouTube and different documentaries about, well, you know, kind of this New World Order subjects. You know, we're going to be hearing a little bit about the SPP and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the North American Union, things like that. So it's kind of a smattering of audio clips to do with those subjects. And also another audio clip. This is called Give Me a Break, Global Warming. Now, I don't know who the fellow is or what station he does his Give Me a Break series. It's a, you know, little 10-minute piece in which he examines something. And this one here, he's looking at global warming, and well done to this fellow. And basically, the debate to weather change is far from over. You know, and one of the things that might make you think that something's a little bit funny is that, you know, they're bringing in these carbon taxes, you know, suggesting incorrectly that it is the citizens who are to blame and are responsible for fixing the problems that our politicians and their corporate masters are doing. So, you know, we got Al Gore winning awards, and, you know, so the establishment has spoken, and, you know, it's that humans are causing global warming, and, well, the debate is not over on that, and a lot of people are saying otherwise, and that's what this clip will look at. Okay, let me see. Right now, I'm going to get into a shorter audio piece. This comes to us from We Are Change Vancouver, and I believe Tosh is the fellow who recorded this segment, and Paul Martin was in Vancouver, and I don't know how recently this was, unfortunately, bad me. However, Tosh with We Are Change Vancouver asked Paul Martin some a pretty good question concerning the SPP, why it was done in secret, and it is quite amazing what former Prime Minister Paul Martin had to say. And of course, he was when he was leader of the Liberals and Prime Minister, that's when the Security and Prosperity Partnership came to be. And it is amazing what he has to say. I've got a quote here. And this is what he claims, is that the SPP agreement was not done in secret. In fact, he says that he kept doing all these press conferences and nobody paid any attention. In fact, he says it was done very publicly. And he also states, he wants to remind you that this is not a treaty. That's why it did not need to go to a vote through Parliament. This is simply an agreement to work together, a cooperative working together. Well, who's working together? It's the 30 big corporations, isn't it? Doing these nasty little things behind our back. And shame on Paul Martin. If this was a just country, I think that you would be behind bars on charges of treason, pal. So what we're going to do, we're going to hear that piece. Then I'm going to give you a further introduction to Jack East of the Marxist-Leninist Party. And then we're going to hit a song while I get Jack on the phone. So let's move on to this fairly recent piece. I'll try to let you know next week exactly when this happened. So this is Paul Martin speaking in Vancouver concerning the SPP and its secrecy, which Paul Martin says it was. He was screaming his lungs out trying to let people know about this. Yeah. Okay, so here it is. See you in a couple minutes.
In 2005, you signed Canada onto the SPP, and it was all done in secret. Why the secrecy, and why are only select corporations allowed in the boardroom?
You know, it's an interesting thing. Obviously, I have more power to you. I think that you're pretty well organized. I've been getting this question across the country from. I actually think that that's good. That's the way it ought to be. But first of all, It wasn't done in secret. There was a press release. There was a the three of us, George Bush and Zenny Fox and myself, met with the press. It was televised. I've got to tell you now, you may say, well, you didn't know very much about it. That's my, probably my problem as Prime Minister. I kept doing these press conferences and nobody paying attention. But the fact is it was done very, very publicly. Now, the reason for it being done was not, as some people have said, to create a North American Union or anything else. There was a recognition of two issues. Number one, that at the time, softwood lumber was a major issue, mad cow was a major issue, and NAFTA wasn't protecting us. From the Mexican point of view, immigration was a major issue, and they felt that NAFTA was not giving them what they were entitled to. And so we both said, listen, there has to be a way in which these things are discussed outside of NAFTA. The second thing is that we recognize that North America is in competition with so many of the great Asian countries for, in fact, for job creation and for a stronger economy, and that there were ways in which we should work together. That's what it was all about. And I can tell you it wasn't done in secret.
Well, how come the media can't go to any of the meetings?
It was. Oh yeah, there was a discussion when, before we went. Actually, there was a discussion in Parliament, and when we came back, there was a discussion in Parliament. Yes, it was. Well, there was. The question was: there a vote in the Parliament? No, there was not. There was no vote. Actually, you know, this was not a treaty. This was simply an agreement to work together. But in fact, under our laws, a treaty does not have to be voted in Parliament. But this was not a treaty. It was simply a cooperative working together.
Oh, you silly conspiracy theorists. You're totally wrong. They are just agreeing to work together. Oh, boy, didn't we mess up on that one, guys? I don't think so. Paul Martin, you should be ashamed of yourself. And, you know, they're going to keep, the media is going to keep calling you a hero and all that crap, you know, like they did with, well, they did it with Reagan and Mulroney, you know, the guys that, you know, sold us out in bigger ways in earlier years. You know, they're winning all these accolades and awards, and it just makes me sick. So, there we are. So well done to We Are Change Vancouver, an activist group there, you know, confronting these former political leaders, and good for them. So let's give an introduction now to this interview with Jack East. Again, he was a candidate in the last two elections in the Nanaimo-Cowichan riding. He's with the Marxist-Leninist Party. And we should not get confused that they are not the Communist Party of Canada, and I'll ask for a clarification on that when he's on. However, he says that, or their website says that the Marxist-Leninist Party stands for pro-social agenda and for an end to the anti-social agenda of the Harper government. And I think we can include quite a few other governments than that. So let me see, I told you that he's run the last two elections. In 06, he received 148 votes. He did a little better this time, 182. That was for 08. And there was five candidates, and he did place number five. But he's a lot more forthcoming with his honesty and his interpretation of what's going on in the world right now. So so good for him. So there we are. Now I'm going to put on a song by Steve Earle. And this is, yesterday was Remembrance Day, and that's a topic that I feel very deeply and conflicted about, and it's real tough. So this song here, it's called The Gringo's Tale by Steve Earle, who is a former U.S. serviceman. He has since left and is, well, I guess a truth teller. And so this song is dedicated to the veterans with courage to speak out about their experiences, who continue to defend their countries in that they see through and report the lies told to us by our politicians and the media. these people who study and report to all who will listen the real reasons they were sent to fight, lest we forget. The enemies of democracy and human rights are not foreign but domestic, lest we forget. Remembrance Day, I feel sadly about, is about bribing into compliant silence the brave men and women who are tragically ill-informed when they sign on to so-called defend Canada in other countries. That's a confusing one, isn't it? So, yeah, I'm sorry. I really wish that these service people, these veterans, would examine the reasons that they were called to go to war, what they're doing in Afghanistan, and report their findings. Very important. That is what a hero is to me. And yeah, you know, we put a picture of a soldier on our quarter, you know, and sorry, but that doesn't make it okay for you to ignore the real reasons of why you were there. So, yeah. All right, so we're going to hear that song. It's called The Gringo's Tale by Steve Earle. This is off his The Revolution Starts Now CD of a couple of years back. And we'll be back with Jack East.
Sleep now and then.
Very nice. That is Steve Earle with The Gringo's Tale. As promised, I want to welcome to the show Jack East. Jack, you there with us?
Yes, I am. I'm here now, Raymond.
Hey, thanks. Welcome to the Unbought and Unbossed show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was telling our listeners a little bit earlier that at the All Candidates meeting earlier, well, I guess 2 months ago, you were willing to talk about some topics that no one else is willing to go near, one being U.S. Empire and the other being the corruption of the international banking institution. So well done to you. So I'm wondering, Jack, if maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how is it that you come to run for the Marxist-Leninist Party these last two federal elections?
Well, my sojourn into politics began in when I was in the University of British Columbia, and I understand this is a campus radio.
That's right.
Well, when I was young, I'm in my 60s now, but at the time there was a missile crisis, and there were 25 minutes away from full exchange of nuclear war heads and such, and there was literally tens of thousands of young people in the streets, and we were holding demonstrations to find out what was going to happen and where we were going to meet. There was demonstrations taking place all over the place asking for change away from the war machine.
Yeah.
Because at that time there was a big threat of nuclear annihilation. So it helped me to see clearly that we should be funding social programs that improve the living standard and definitely the working conditions, and definitely not get involved towards nuclear war and supporting aggressive war.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I decided that perhaps I wouldn't be able to make all the courses because we were in the streets, and it was very active times. People were meeting constantly and every week and holding huge meetings. There was 5,000 here against nuclear weapons. There was people organizing. Various parties were coming into being. It was a time when they said the 60s was developing towards a revolutionary perspective for the new generation.
Okay, so you were in the thick of that?
Yes, we were in the thick of that. And so then we started to organize, and it just happens that I'm still continuously organizing because while we actively took part in opposing the U.S. aggression against Indochina, and the poison chemical sprays and all the threats of nuclear war and all the killings, over 3 million killed by the U.S. military and its aggression and its phony allies, then it shifted over. We had a relative period of peace, and then it's gone into a full-out going for oil and wars in which the U.S. imperialists have murdered millions of people in the world's holy land. That's 7,000 years of a written language and culture, and they don't see, they were still in the caves when they were holding civilization with a written language.
Yeah.
So they have very little respect for culture, and that's what I find. And there is a world economy. Why don't they live up to it instead of destroying it?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
This senseless slaughter of people for the oil profits of the big oil corporations has got to stop. And so out of all of this came the movement for change, and in that was the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party of Canada formed in 1970, and we've moved forward since then trying to say to the people that while the United States has spent $7 trillion to defame communism and defame the working class taking over the state and running society because they're the only ones doing all the work so they know how to work it,
okay.
We therefore are suggesting to the people that they need a change from governments that are in constant war, permanent war. Bush has declared we are now in an epoch of permanent war. And this is not what we need as students. We need our tuition paid for like they do in Cuba. We need our health care paid for like they do in Cuba. And we need an end to these useless, senseless wars that are polluting this environment, this world, and causing us not to have a secure future.
Yeah.
and that's basically why I joined into the political struggle. And we have since had, for myself, we only ran 59 candidates, but we still got 6,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
And we did less than we did last time because we had 85 candidates. But what I'm saying is it's going to take a lot of education. It's going to take a lot of hard work. And we're going to have to take Canada back because, as you well know, there's a whole series of colonial treaties made in the United States that is taking over our resources and deindustrializing Canadian ownership
yeah.
and putting in American imperialist ownership. And what that means is we won't have choices as to what we will be doing. Our sovereignty and our independence is being taken away from us, but not for good reasons. It's for the reasons of supplying iron ore and oil to a nation that has declared permanent war.
Yeah, the military-industrial in the show, yeah.
That's it. And it's not only a military-industrial complex, it's also now the leading prison complex
mm-hmm.
in the industrial world.
Good point.
And so what are we going to do about that? I mean to say it's growing. And so all the time they're saying, like, honey on their lips. They're saying, like, oh, we're the democracy. Oh, we're the freedom. The weapons of mass destruction are out there. But they never say on TV that the United States is the biggest weapon seller in the world, the biggest manufacturer of weapons. And every September, the Pentagon holds a bazaar where it sells to all sides, not just anybody who has money. They can buy their sophisticated weapons.
Yeah.
And such a system has gone into a military phase. And that's what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s, and now it's reoccurring again. And it's a very dangerous situation. And so we wanted to say that for us, we want an anti-war government in Canada so we can peacefully work with the world and trade with friends, not with enemies that is going to take us over and run our economy.
Right. In the literature for the Marxist-Leninist Party at their website suggests that they stand for a pro-social agenda and to end the current anti-social agenda of the Harper government, and I'm going to include governments prior to that one. What actual things could you suggest as far as making Canada a pro-social democracy?
Well, here's just an example. After I left university, I went and joined in with the CNR, Canadian National Railway.
Okay.
I became a conductor, a yard foreman conductor. I worked out of the Vancouver terminal.
All right.
And now, what happened there is indicative of what's happening in the Industrial Revolution in Canada. The United States took over and now owns 70% of the Canadian National Railway, and that meant the Canadian workers struggling for Canadian unions were more or less down the road because the American imperial order does not favor workers having their own decisions, improving their own living conditions. It does not favor them having unions that are not obeying the American dictate. So away down the road goes our future and the future of the students because there's the railways. The other thing is we are environmentally friendly with the railways if they are transferred over to electric.
Okay.
And that would end the pollution, which would involve the native people whose religion is the great outdoors. They don't believe in polluting things because then it gets into the food chain and it pollutes them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the question there is, when can we have a nation-building project in Canada that we can restore the sovereignty of this country? We have to take over our own means of production because the Canadian people built Canada, not the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would have a chance again. They when they came here, they took away the rights of passengers. This is how they put money first instead of people. They took away the passenger rights of superiority in passenger trains and and made it into a sort of like a freight train. First come, first go through the gate like this, but that puts everybody late when you leave from Vancouver to Toronto. You come in 10 hours late. And it's inevitable it's going to be late because you're sitting behind their coal trains now.
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting behind their wheat trains. You're sitting behind their iron ore trains. You're sitting behind all the resources. You're waiting, whereas before, when we made up passenger trains going out of Vancouver on the CN main line, every other train across Canada had to clear our time and get off the track. And that put us into terminals on time, and people could make relative or job appointments or meetings for health and everything, and it would all be on time. Not so now. And they do that only because they put money first and instead of passengers. And so what happens is the United States government doesn't put people first, it puts money first. And so some guy in New York just says, oh, hold it up, here, let them wait behind the coal train, because we make $1 billion a year on coal, but we don't. But on passengers, we only make $10 million. So the passengers end up sitting on the sidetrack for hours.
Okay.
And it's just a whole deregulation, and they cut the crew sizes down from 5 people for a freight crew down to 3.
Hmm.
We lost the caboose on the main line, so we can't cover the movement of trains on both sides. And all this is done at our expense, because if you cut down the number of crew that it can't cover the safety codes, because it needs 5 people per freight crew to cover the safety codes, and they've got it down to 2 and 3, 2 on the main line and 3 in the yard,
mm-hmm.
There's bound to be, therefore, accidents, and that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's discouraging to the people, the workers. And so when they have strikes, they're nationwide, and they're condemning the American ownership. And so it's not a happy situation, and that coupled with the fact that they know very well they shouldn't be warring for oil,
mm-hmm.
and the unjust wars that are going on, is indicative that we have a need for democratic renewal in Canada so that we can fulfill our futures. And on this Vancouver Island, I've been working here for 41 years just on the side to get a nation-building project of a railway from Victoria to Port Hardy. And we want the correct crew sizes on there, and we want electricity, and we want to work with the Native people on this with equal hiring and equal pay. And that would give us an environmentally protected area in the Industrial Revolution,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't pollute.
What's the likelihood of that? What's the response from the powers that be?
Well, okay. We got 81% support. I spoke for the people at the Canadian Transportation Commission meeting after I got blacklisted. Tommy Douglas phoned me up and his office sent me some papers to come and speak on maintaining the ENN railway from Victoria to Courtney. But you see, they were going to cancel it. We got it kept on, but the CPR wouldn't put money in to repair the tracks or get new equipment or put in an electric thing. So what they did was, we just won't fix it then. If we can't cancel it, we won't really throw in with the people and make an enthusiastic nation-building project.
Yeah.
So it's in limbo, kind of. And what they did was give $339 million to the railway workers there, and then they left it in their hands, with the Via Rail and the rest of it. But what we need is some... we had at our CTC, the Canadian Transportation Commission hearings, in Courtney, Nanaimo, and Victoria, we had... 81% support from the people, a very enthusiastic support,
mm-hmm.
On the entire island. So it's not the people who are sabotaging this. It's the big corporations, the Americans, at the same time were passing the NAFTA, May, FTA, and now the latest and worst is SPP.
Right.
And to take the democracy out of the hands of the people and put it into the hands of the American corporations and military.
Yeah.
And the SPP goes so far as to say, if Canada has no right whatsoever to block any resources.
Yeah.
And if they do, then they will be subjected to all kinds of colonial laws that will force them somehow militarily or politically to, or fine them. And it's a horrible situation. And the people are being left out of the democracy. So our party is saying, look, we have to form a chance for the Canadian people to make their own decisions. We know it's good to have a railway from Victoria to Port Hardy that doesn't pollute and can look after our needs.
Mm-hmm.
But they have blocked it across by buying out the Canadian National Railway, the British Columbia Railway, and right across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens now, now they just bought out Stelco about 6 months ago. United States Steel makes Canadian... See, Stelco was the main maker of Canadian steel in Canada. Now it's owned by U.S. Steel. Where is that steel going? All your labor is going... What are they supplying their armies and tanks and all their bombers and the means of destruction instead of means of production?
Yeah.
This lets us our future out of our own hands.
Yeah, could very well be. Hey, I'm a big fan of media studies, and one of the things that relates to that is the whole stigma attached to communism. And of course, you know, the Western powers demonized communism for so long that you know, they rather effectively, you know, blackened the eye of the communist movement.
Yeah.
And its goals.
Yeah. Well, the goal I say for everybody, if they really wish to go to the genius of Marx and Engels, the founders of communism in the modern world, and you'll find them on the opening page saying, "Workers of the world, unite." Now, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
That's what should happen. As a foreign policy, workers of the world, unite would eliminate war, poverty, pollution, and gender discrimination. Women should be elected equal by now. This is a new millennium.
Yeah.
That was taken away from them by the empires. But it used to exist before the conquest. It should be restored, and that would double democracy. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say is that kind of philosophy, the United States has spent $7 trillion since 1945, made 70,000 nuclear bombs, and to obliterate that kind of theory. They say, oh, you can't have that. Man's superior to women. Well, so did the Germans. The Germany under Hitler tried that, but I mean, well, we want to say no. We don't want to be under militarism, and we don't want to be under only the men's them all the time. We want half and half, 50-50 electing, so women can access half the lawmaking and half the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that would restore the matriarchy and the patriarchy, and that would be ecological green balance of the species. And the harmony and joy that is the natural condition of man, the man-woman question on Earth, would come back to our species. It is missing now because of the alienation of the wars, the pollution, and the destruction and corruption in government at the expense of the working class and working people of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. We talked a couple days ago. One of the points you mentioned was U.S. imperialism and unions. We've partly touched on that now. And I guess what I wanted to say is that any democracy that's legitimate, I think, would naturally evolve towards a socialist type system where the peoples, you know, are running the show. And I don't.
Yeah, that's the what they don't want, because they're giving. Look at this bailout that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who have caused all the corruption at the top and paid the rich instead of equitably distributing the wealth, which is a communist principle. Instead of that, they put it into fewer and fewer hands, which creates the fact that economically, the millions, the masses, the tens of millions are not having economic control over their working conditions and therefore over their lives, and are the victims of the gambling that the stock market is. And when it collapses because of the pollution and the war and the need to retool to non-pollution solutions such as wind, tidal, and solar power, which is electricity, that would take 97% of the pollution right out of the air just like that. But they won't do it, see? And now they're in big trouble, and all the scientists are telling them, look, we're in a crisis. And this is what Marxism-Leninism found out and told them a long time ago. The great genius of Marxism is that Karl Marx pointed out these contradictions as they put the wealth into fewer and fewer hands because of their control of their state, which is a bourgeois state, a bourgeois democracy, where the workers have to obey or they're down the road or and starve to death or their houses are taken away or they can't pay. There's prisons full of them because they stole a loaf of bread.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys at the top, they're rigging it now. They're going to pay the bankers. Why don't they pay the one and a half million workers who just lost their houses? Why don't they give them the money so they can continue to live in their own houses?
Good point.
And instead of that, they're paying the same guys who caused the crisis in the first place. So they're getting richer at the top, and the vast mass, the 80%, are getting poorer.
Mm-hmm. Your volume's starting to lower. If you can maybe address that somehow.
Okay.
Now, but before we head into a short break here for some commercial purposes.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a new president elect in the States.
Yeah.
And a lot of people appear to actually think that this fellow is going to represent the change that so many want. What are your thoughts on that quickly?
Well, here, I would never take away and say that it's not good that a black man is elected. For one thing, the United States owes the black people billions of dollars of reparations for non-payment of wages, and they owe them a lot. But the trouble is, Obama, when asked about will he make the reparations for the black people that the billions of dollars owed to them because they weren't paid, he said no. Plus, he's talked on two-facedly. He talks on the one hand, he says to the people, we want to get out of this Iraq war. It was a mistake from the beginning. We withdraw the troops. And then he turns around when he talks to the military. He says, we must bomb Pakistan. We must send more troops, more brigades into Afghanistan. Now, that's all phony. There's no need for that. There's no threat to the United States from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, or Palestine, or any of the Iran. And he's threatening Iran. And now he's lying that Iran's making a nuclear bomb. And Iran has peaceful uses of atomic energy, which is guaranteed to them in the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Iran is totally legal and correct by international law. The United States is not. Mm-hmm. The Nuremberg trial says the planning and doing of aggressive war is the supreme international crime on earth, because it actuates all other crimes, high, low, and big and small.
Yeah.
And it sets that in motion. Now, they are actually invading and shooting and killing and bombing, and they are totally doing a war criminal thing according to the Geneva Conventions of War, to which the United States government and Canada has signed on to.
Yeah. That's right.
They're breaking their own national and international laws and breaking the Constitution, and that is why Obama was chosen over
McCain,
because McCain is too obvious.
Yeah.
But Obama, when he's talking to the mass, we need change, and we've got, you know, and he's talking that, and he's got this just cause of being elected because he's black.
Yeah.
People want to try him on, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't blame them for that. They wanted that. But I think because of who he's appointing for his cabinet, like Warren Buffett, a billionaire who's a warmonger,
yeah.
And
Brzezinski. Yeah, that's right.
These guys were all the planners of invading and occupying the Middle East and taking over the oil.
Yeah, it just seems to be a well-spoken puppet this time.
Yeah, but I, you know, they are, even the ruling class, even though they're being paid billions of dollars, they're still in a crisis because they see the masses are rising. And that's why Bush was passing the Patriot Act, which enabled concentration camps to be built in the United States to the capacity of 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's being done right now.
That's right.
And so he's preparing to suppress the American people should they rise.
Yeah.
You know, and but the American people are getting prepared to rise. I mean, when they can't recruit on campuses anymore, when they, all their officers are throwing blood in their windows and calling them murderers, and, you know, it's demonstrations everywhere throughout the United States. When they hold a demonstration against the war, people like Answer Coalition and the International Action Center and the various people's organizations, they get literally millions of people in 200 or 300 cities.
Yeah.
The people are rising, all right, and so they have to have a campaign. The ruling class is afraid of that. They're afraid of their own people. And so what they've done is they've taken a candidate that speaks well to the people because he comes from the people. And therefore he can, they want him to use him, to bail them out. And he even, McCain or Obama even voted for the bailout, which is taking the money from the working class, the source of the wealth, and giving it to the bankers who were the source of the problem at the, in the first place.
Yeah.
So there's a real confusion in that guy. I think he's sort of like an orangeman. He's not really red, although he likes to talk red. He's not really white. And so he represents something that's sort of unknown, and I think time will prove that his appointment of all the people that have caused the problem and not the solution, and his abandonment of even talking of the working class. I've never heard him once say the working class. And they're the majority, eh?
I'm going to, I think I'm going to test him out whether or not he repeals many of the things that the Bush administration did over the last 7 years. You know, if he starts dismantling those and getting back to, you know, the Constitution, then I'm going to say, okay, maybe this fellow is...
Yeah, same here. I mean, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
It's a long time since we've been... If he could end the wars, even that, just bring the troops home and give reparations. That's what the Iraq war veterans say. They have 3 points. End the war now, bring the troops home, pay reparations, and give us Medicare, which you're not doing. They're sleeping in the bloody street, and horses are stomping on them when they question and want to stop the war.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Jack, thank you. Things are going just swell here. However, I do need to do a campus community update.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to ask of you is that you stay on the phone, but you can go and take care of business for maybe 3 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And then come on back, and we'll continue our interview after that.
Okay,
fantastic.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
All right. See, talk to you shortly.
Yeah.
I think we're going to leave it at that for now. I want to, boy, we got about 4 minutes to nine. And this is a good time to tell you that those campus community updates have been brought to you by the fine people at Vancouver 9/11 Truth, Victoria 9/11 Truth, and Edmonton 9/11 Truth. They are all financial supporters of CHLY, and they recognize the importance of independent media. And shows like this one, which is the Unbought and Unbossed show. I am your host, Raymond Geisler. If you would like to contact me, the email address is raymondtruthradio@hotmail.com. That's raymondtruthradio@hotmail.com. I do archive my shows. My website is, well, it's more of a blog style. It's a journal. It's unbossed.livejournal.com. And I'll tell you who was on, what was on, the songs, the articles I read, as well as a link to the audio downloadable or live streaming audio segment from that episode. So there you go. Let's see. Jack, are you with us?
Yes, I'm listening.
Oh, good, good. Okay. Well, let's put rest to the campus community updates, and welcome back our guest, Jack East, a local activist. Now, are you out of the Campbell River area?
Yeah, I live in the Campbell River area. But,
okay.
What happened there was my folks, they were retired from the Okanagan and came to Surrey to live, but they were robbed four times. So I had to say to them, look, they're anti-fascist fighters from the Second World War. I says, you deserve better than to be robbed in your home just because you're old and retired. I said, let's get out of this place and find some place where they don't do that. So we ended up here in Campbell River.
Okay. Yeah, it's a nice town. I spent a little bit of time there.
Yeah, well, it's got that problem of the pulp mill and its pollution, but it's closing down on the 30th of November, so we won't have that problem anymore.
For permanent?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was the biggest polluter in all the pulp mills in British Columbia.
Well, I knew it was a big one. My goodness.
Well, so, yeah. Well, they're trying to shake it up too. Here's another thing that the Marxist-Leninists have done. What we did was say, okay, pulp, hemp, not trees. That will save the West Coast forest because mm-hmm. 1 acre of hemp equals 5 or 4 acres of West Coast rainforest.
Okay.
But the hemp is a better paper. We also said get electric boilers, then you won't have smoke going up in the air. And the lie that it's done by clean coal, that's just a company lie, so that they won't be in trouble or nobody will think they're doing it. Gassed with carbon dioxide and sulfates. And
yeah, from what I understand, this whole clean coal technology is a load of malooey, yeah.
Yeah, it's the boss's plum. You see, the people are becoming more and more conscious because the people going to university, they study ecology, they study the environment, and so on and so forth. So now they're questioning, why are you polluting like this? And so they have to greenwash. And all the companies greenwash, they talk, we're going to sell you carbon taxes and whatever. But, I mean, it's just fictive capitalism. It's fictive capitalism in the sense there's no value to the words they're saying anymore
mm-hmm.
and what they're doing. So now they're having to close down because everybody's tired of having their salmon and their crabs and their oysters and their shellfish and the prawns polluted, eh? And they don't even taste good anymore. So it's overdue, but it's indicative of the rise of the people's consciousness as that we need to put in non-pollution solution such as electric boilers there.
Okay, yeah. So now what's going to happen to those? Is there another plant going to be to replace it, or are we just out of those jobs straight up? What's happening there?
Well, from what I heard now, it's kind of uncertain, but I think it takes a while to shut it all down. As of November 30th, it'll be shut down, but they'll still have people taking it out of service till next March.
Okay.
The end of March. And then it's permanent.
What's the number of employees at that when it's running full time?
I think it's like 800, but I'm not sure exactly.
Okay.
And already they've taken the sawmills. We should have had a little discussion on the forestry because the Yankees are taking over our forest. And they're shutting down the sawmills, so we'll have to buy our lumber from the United States.
Yeah.
And that's no lie. That's like about 15 sawmills that just in the last couple of decades have shut down.
Yeah.
And it's really in colonial treaties that NAFTA. It should be abolished immediately, and we should take back Canada and work it for the Canadian people. We should nationalize the banks and then pay the people as they're needed.
There's
no reason why we don't have a full income in this whole country.
Yeah.
We've got trillions and billions of dollars. We don't have to have people unemployed and only the rich survive.
Yeah.
That's no way.
I agree with you 100% there. Hey, yesterday was Remembrance Day.
Yeah.
Do you celebrate that in any way? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Every time I can, I wear a poppy and I say to the people, now, my folks fought against fascism in two world wars in the 1st Canadian Division, and their battle plan was to scrap the war machine and thereby provide the possibility of freeing the people. Well, Bush, he's got to scrap the people and free the war machine, totally backwards. And so, no, I don't go there to beat the drums and grandize war. I go there to propagate the idea of abolishing war on this planet and putting the money into technology that's in solidarity with life rather than destroying life.
Nice. I like that. Hey, we're just about out of time. Yeah. I'm going to ask you to give your final thoughts, and if there's a website you want listeners to visit or a news agency that you want to recommend. So I'm going to give you a couple minutes here to finish your piece, and then we're going to carry on.
Yeah, okay. I just want to say that I think the Canadian people need a change in society, that we should take back all the foreign ownership, pay off those that we have to, and take over the rest and run it in our own favor. Because it's not the Americans or the British or anybody else that built Canada. It's the working class of Canada that built Canada. And you can imagine the disappointment and alienation it caused to see all your hard-earned labor and for generations being taken away by foreigners. It's like how England ruled Ireland with absentee landlords. We won't be making the laws. They make the laws. We'll lose our future. We don't even. And they're slashing the crew sizes down and running us. So they're not going for unions. We need to get Canadian unions for Canadian workers, and to function this society in the benefit of the Canadian people. It's a betrayal to sell out our country to the highest bidders. And they did that in Norway and Quisling and all the rest of it. But we don't encourage that. We encourage that the Canadian people should own and control Canada, because that's the country that they worked for generations to build up. And we want an independent and free Canada.
Hear, hear.
So, and the other thing I would just say, it's getting very dangerous, because if Obama takes the path after January 20th of bombing Pakistan and invading Pakistan and sending troops into Afghanistan and into Iran and threatening them again with nuclear war, we're going to have to change that system there too, and the people are getting ready to do just that. And I mean, like millions and millions of dispossessed working people really seeking and desperately needing to have a government that functions in their favor, and that would be a government that's in favor of the workers. And Marx and Engels only said this, that each state, because of the core majority being the working class, each state should be a worker state that could put an end to war, poverty, pollution, and free the public sector to the people, and provide a decent living for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's about the best thing I could possibly say. The propaganda on the TV against us is they spend hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars to lie about what we are. And but we're only in favor of an independent Canada that works and is socialist and is democratic and would elect women equally, doubling democracy judicially and politically.
Yeah. Well, those are fantastic goals. And, Jack East, I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, be well,
well,
my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really surprised. You know, usually they give me a ticket or something.
Well, we didn't get into 9/11. This is a 9/11 show.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a pretty progressive show. And again, I want to thank you for your input this week.
Okay. Well, sometime we'll see you later in the future then.
Okay, partner. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night. Okay. There we go. That was Jack East, a two-time candidate with the Marxist-Leninist Party. He's run in the Nanaimo-Cowichan ridings. So there we are, a peace and political activist there. Good for him. Not too many people, you can say, well, what are you doing to help your cause? Oh, I'm running in the federal election. Oh, well done. So there we are. We're going to move on now to a couple audio pieces. I've got a song, and then that longer, the Complete Idiot's Guide to the New World Order. And, you know, that starts off, we're listening to some, well, Eisenhower and Kennedy giving some warnings, and then they're going to talk about, you know, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Amero, which you can expect to see before too long, you know, again, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, which, according to Martin, well, it's not a treaty, it's just simply an agreement to work together, quote, a cooperative working together. So says Paul Martin. Okay, then. So that'll be the snippets of New World Order topics. But first off, we're going to hear a song. This is by Rancid, and it's called Life Won't Wait. The Vision is a New World Order. So I'll get back to you folks in about 10 or 12. Hang in.
Councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it.
On the outskirts of the national capital today, black limousines with darkened windows converged the hotel where private security guards imposed ironclad control. The limos carried royalty, political power brokers, and industrial titans to a secret meeting that will last all weekend. It's known as the Bilderberg Group. Could their objective be world domination?
Council on Foreign Relations. Professor Carol Quigley is allowed to examine the confidential papers and secret records of this network. Quigley reveals that these men aim to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. In short, they seek total and quiet control of the entire world. And the CFR is their most visible conduit for carrying out that agenda.
What I'm about to say is fact. The secret organizations of the world power elite are no longer secret. They have planned and are now leading us into a one-world communist government.
CNN has even reported that these individuals have put out the policy reports through the Council on Foreign Relations that writes their scholarly white papers to end the United States, to end Canada, and to end Mexico.
I hate to break it to you, but after 2 years of denying it and saying this can't be, it's the only reason that I have found that explains everything that's going on in our country with the border. Our country has been sold out in the name of global profits and votes at the ballot box. This is where the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or SPP, comes in. This little agreement, international agreement, cooked up by President Bush, the former president of Mexico, and the Prime Minister of Canada. Their mission is to blur or completely erase the borders between Canada, U.S., and Mexico.
Romero is the proposed new currency for the North American community, which is being developed right now between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico to make a borderless community much like the EU, and the dollar, Canadian dollar, U.S. dollar, and the Mexican peso replaced by the Romero.
Security and Prosperity Partnership, which critics call nothing more than a North American Union. It means open borders, commerce at all costs, and by the way, without the approval of either American voters or the U.S. Congress.
And very unfortunately, like the euro dollar, you mean? Well, that would be long, long term.
Now, even the economists supporting the so-called globalism, and it's not free trade.
Worse, critics say foreign policy elites are promoting a European-style union, erasing borders between the three countries, and eventually moving to a single North American currency called the Amero.
Via 4,000-mile network of new toll roads with truck and car lanes, rail lines, pipeline, and utility zones. Its projected cost, $183 billion over 50 years.
By default of this agreement, the American Constitution will eventually be obsolete. You would think that a situation like this would be on the cover of every major newspaper. That is until you realize that the people who are behind this movement are the same people behind the mainstream media, and you are not told what you're not supposed to know. The North American Union is the same concept as the European Union, the African Union, and the soon-to-be Asian Union, and the same people are behind all of them. And when the time is right, the North American Union, the European Union, the African Union, and the Asian Union will be merged together.
Vice President Dick Cheney takes a question from David Rockefeller.
Vice President, I just enjoyed so much your whole speech, but I was particularly pleased that you gave such a strong endorsement for the free trade agreement for all the Americans.
It's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming.
I've never registered as a Republican, but generally speaking. But I think most Americans now say neither side. They're both selling us out.
One who supported giving President Bush the authority, if necessary, to use force against Saddam Hussein.
Well, I have a number of people from whom I get policy. I'm talking to Frank Gaffney. I talked to Richard Haass.
Richard Haass served under Colin Powell during this Bush administration over at the State Department. He's now the president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
The idea of a one world community, a new world order. You know, they see that.
They see themselves as a government as opposed to a group of world leaders or people with influence at a global level who are talking about global issues, do they?
They see themselves as headhunters. They'll get an up and coming politician who they think may be president or prime minister one day, and as globalist industrialist leaders who believe that politics shouldn't be in the hands of the politicians.
People talk to me about, you know, the issue of Republican versus Democrat as if they don't get it. And I say, look, here's the way you get it. It's organized crime. All you do is you call the Republicans the Genoveses, and you call the Democrats the Gambinos. The people at the top, they treat it like a crap game, like it's their crap game, like they're making lots of money. Occasionally, somebody at the table shoots each other, but the moment anything threatens their crap game, they all unite to protect it. They're both controlled by the same financial, economic, and corporate interests.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order.
It used to be more secretive. You know, the new world order was talked about 30 or 40 years ago, and nobody would say it out and open. Now they talk about the new world order. They just think the world would be better off if we had one world government.
Right.
I don't. I mean, I don't even like the size of our federal government, let alone one world government.
There's a need for a new world order.
Within the next 4 years, we will see the emergence of a new international
order. The beginning. Of a new international order.
But there's a very, very clear-cut and easily identifiable system in place that puts all of these elements, from media control to government control to energy control, together into one apparatus working together effectively towards its final goal, which is, you know, global control.
A new world is emerging.
It is a new world order.
It's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
There is a chance for the President of the United States to use this disaster to carry out what his father, a phrase his father used, and that is a new world order.
They decided to bow, conspiracy, if you will, to take control of the United States, lead us into a one world government run by them.
Americans in the positive perspective of salvation from government, instead of recognizing government as the most dangerous threat they'll face in their lives.
Okay, welcome back to the show. I'm trying to play a the membership. Thank you for pledging, but it's not playing right now, unfortunately. Son of a gun. I don't use the Win app here very often, so that's not my thing. But okay, so what we heard there was Rancid, Life Won't Wait, The Vision is a New World Order, and then the Complete Idiot's Guide to the New World Order. So there we are. We heard a lot of different presidents, and so that's lots of different information and researchers there on what is likely going down. The consolidation of power is what it's about, and a big thing that is working towards, you know, really jump-starting this consolidation is, well, the 9/11 tragedy. And I just so happen to have my favorite researcher and author of that movement, Dr. David Ray Griffin. His latest book is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up and the Exposé. This is by Olive Branch Press, 2005. I'm going to read from the preface, and I'm going to do that for a couple reasons. One, he outlines, well, the history of the truth movement, or at least a number of main aspects of it, and he's played a rather significant role in it with the publication of his numerous books, Uncovering the Problems in the Official Story. And this preface is going to address these issues and more. So let's get into this. So here it is, the brand new David Ray Griffin book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. So here we are from the preface. My first book about 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, was published early in 2004, with a second updated edition appearing a few months later. The present volume was prompted by two facts about the discussion of 9/11 in the intervening years. On the one hand, although 9/11 was indisputably the most fateful event of our time, from which enormous consequences, almost entirely negative, have flowed, neither Congress nor the mainstream media have investigated the reasons provided by independent researchers from many professions for considering the official account false. On the other hand, five major developments have occurred that have changed the discussion since the appearance of New Pearl Harbor. One major development was the publication of the 9/11 Commission Report in July 2004. Prior to its publication, a portion of the community of researchers seeking the truth about 9/11 still hoped that the 9/11 Commission would prove to be a truth-seeking body. Some of these optimistic readers, hopeful to assist the Commission, even sent it copies of my New Pearl Harbor, which was widely regarded as the best summary of the main discoveries made by the community of independent researchers, who are generally called the 9/11 Truth Movement. But when the Commission's report appeared, it confirmed the expectations of the movement's most pessimistic members. Rather than confronting the evidence summarized in New Pearl Harbor and elsewhere that suggests official complicity, the Commission simply presupposed the truth of the government's theory, according to which the 9/11 attacks resulted from a conspiracy involving only Osama bin Laden and other Arab Muslims. That is a pretty good word, presupposed, to prejudge, prejudice. So presupposed. Carrying on, all the contrary information provided in New Pearl Harbor and elsewhere was either ignored or simply omitted in the Commission's final report. One of the most remarkable omissions was its failure even to mention that Building 7 of the World Trade Center had collapsed, perhaps because FEMA, which had put out a preliminary report on the World Trade Center in 2002, admitted that its best explanation for this collapse had only a low probability of occurrence. Well, they since brought out the official story on Building 7 a couple months back, and they say it is fire only. So that would make it the first time that a steel structure collapsed due to fire only. Remember, no jet plane hit Building 7. Carrying on. A second major development was the publication of the 2005 of the official report of the destruction of the Twin Towers by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. Although this report had been accepted by the mainstream press as an authoritative explanation, many scientists have argued that NIST could appear to explain the collapses of these buildings only by ignoring several types of evidence and even violating various laws of physics. Further criticism of NIST's report had been evoked by the fact that, although it is supposed to deal not only with the Twin Towers, but also with World Trade Center Building 7, NIST has repeatedly delayed its explanation for the third building's collapse. A third major development was the publication of in 2006 of two polls indicating that a significant percentage of the American people rejected or at least doubted the official account of 9/11. A Zogby poll indicated that 72% of the population believed that, quote, the U.S. government and its 9/11 commission concealed critical evidence that contradicts their official explanation of the September 11 attacks. Even more significant was a Scripps-Howard/Ohio University poll, which found 36% of the public believing that, quote, federal officials either participated in the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, or took no action to stop them because they wanted the U.S. to go to war in the Middle East. This later poll led Time magazine to comment, 36% adds up to a lot of people. This is not a fringe phenomenon. It is a mainstream political reality. Carrying on, these polls suggested that the 9/11 truth movement, in spite of the hostility of the mainstream press, had been increasingly successful. That success, which, to anyone paying attention, had been apparent long before these polls publicized the fact. Perhaps it even lay behind a new approach to the 9/11 truth movement adopted by defenders of the official account. Prior to the summer of 2006, the official reports had dealt with the movement by ignoring it. The reports by NIST and the 9/11 Commission did not even acknowledge the existence of an alternative account of 9/11, according to which it was an inside job, whether fully or at least in. But in August 2006, four official and semi-official publications appeared that explicitly sought to debunk this alternative account. One of the semi-official publications was a book by Popular Mechanics entitled Debunking 9/11 Myths. This new strategy constituted a fourth major development. A fifth major development was the influx of intellectuals and professionals into the 9/11 truth community. This community now includes various organizations of intellectuals, such as Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, and SPINE, the scientific panel investigating 9/11. Partly to emphasize this development, Peter Dale Scott and I edited the 2006 book entitled 9/11 and American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out. The movement also now includes a growing number of professionals, many of whom belong to some specialized organization, such as Veterans for 9/11 Truth, Pilots for 9/11 Truth, and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I'll also add Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. They're the newest. This influx of intellectuals and professionals also led to the creation of a scholarly journal, the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Statements by hundreds of intellectuals and professionals who believe that a new investigation is needed can now conveniently be read online at Patriots Question 9/11. And I believe that is a .org. So Patriots Question 9/11. That's a fantastic site. I'm going to pause there. We're about halfway through this, the preface to the new Pearl Harbor Revisited, David Ray Griffin's latest contribution to the 9/11 truth movement. So I'm going to put on another song. This one here is by Tom Petty, Don't Fade on Me. So, all you truthers out there, let's keep it together. Let's keep this movement going, and let's get some justice out of this. So, don't fade on me, eh?
I remember you so clearly, the first one through the door, and I returned to find you drifting too far from the shore. I remember feeling this way, you can lose it without knowing. You wake up and you don't notice which way the wind is blowing. Don't fade. No, don't fade on me.
That is Tom Petty with Don't Fade on Me. That's from his Wallflowers album maybe, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, a little while back now. My, how time flies, isn't it? So welcome back to the Unbought and Unbossed show on CHLY. We're 101.7 on the dial, FM. We're also online at chly.ca, in which you can listen live streaming. So if you're out of our listening area, that's where you can be listening to this. And also you can listen to archives of this show if you go to the website unbossed.livejournal.com. So what we were doing is taking a look at the preface to the maybe the newest 9/11 Truth book out. It's David Ray Griffin's new one, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. David Ray Griffin is my favorite researcher and an author. I strongly suggest that if you're new to 9/11 studies, that Dr. Griffin would be a good place to go. Google his name, watch some of his lectures, read some of his articles. He has numerous books out. He's a big player in this movement, and so well done, Dr. Griffin. So let's carry on here, in which he's giving a brief historical outline of the movement and some of the major things that happened, and you know the government's response, which is where we're at now. You know they know that that many people are waking up to the numerous problems in the official story, and so let's see where we're going to go with this. So he says, thanks to the growing number of intellectuals and professionals, including physicists, chemists, architects, engineers, pilots, military officers, intelligence officers, and political leaders who have publicly rejected the official story, the case against that story is now much stronger than it was in 2004, as he showed in his 2007 book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, in which I responded to the four documents of August 2006 that tried to refute the claims of the 9/11 Truth Movement. This strengthening of the 9/11 Truth Movement's composition and its case against the official story may help explain the fact that a Scripps Howard Ohio University poll taken in late 2007 showed a dramatic decrease in the number of Americans who are confident about the truth of the official account. Only 30% of the respondents considered not likely the idea that federal officials had received specific warnings about the 9/11 attacks, but decided to ignore them. This finding suggests that a clear majority of the American people would be ready for a true investigation into 9/11. Even after all these developments, however, both Congress and the mainstream press have continued to refuse to investigate the dozens of reasons the 9/11 Truth community has provided for considering the official account false. These reasons include the fact that the 9/11 Commission's report contains dozens of falsehoods, whether explicit or merely implicit. As I show in my 2005 critique, the 9/11 Commission report, omissions and distortions. These reasons also include the existence of massive contradictions between the official story and some basic laws of physics, which David Ray Griffin documented in his Debunking 9/11 Debunking, citing the analysis of Stephen Jones and Kevin Ryan, as well as other scientists. These reasons include, moreover, many internal contradictions within the official story, as I demonstrated in my first 2008 book, 9/11 Contradictions, An Open Letter to Congress and the Press. And in that book, David Ray Griffin took 25 examples of major contradictions within the official story itself. So 25 clear lies, just, read and pay attention carefully what they're saying. And, David Ray Griffin kept finding him in a bunch of lies. Nevertheless, while acknowledging that the Bush administration's response to 9/11, based on its public account of it, has been overwhelmingly destructive for both America and the rest of the world, both our elected representatives and the Fourth Estate have thus far ignored the massive amount of evidence pointing to the falsity of that account. The idea of writing the new Pearl Harbor Revisited arose because of a twofold fact about the new Pearl Harbor. On the one hand, besides containing some errors, it had become increasingly out of date. On the other hand, it continued to be, in spite of these flaws, widely regarded as the best and most readable introduction to the issues. During the past few years, however, many people have urged me to write an updated edition. Although they knew that I had responded to some of the new developments in the aforementioned books, they pointed out that it would be important to have all the information most essential for evaluating the official story in an easily accessible form. Besides being helpful to ordinary citizens who have come to suspect the falsity of the official story, this would be vital if Congress and the press were finally to decide to investigate the problems in that story. Busy senators, representatives, and journalists could not be expected to search through several books to find the relevant information about this issue. The question was how to update New Pearl Harbor without losing two of its most oft remarked virtues, its brevity and its readability. So what did they do? Well, the publisher and I arrived at the following solution. New Pearl Harbor is reprinted as a first volume of a two-volume set. The second volume, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, is a chapter-by-chapter commentary on the first volume, in which its discussion is brought up to date and, where necessary, corrected. The updating consists partly of information contained here and there in my intervening books, and partly of information I had not previously discussed. The fact that New Pearl Harbor and New Pearl Harbor Revisited have been published as companion volumes in a two-book set does not mean that they must be purchased together. Readers who already have New Pearl Harbor may simply purchase the new one by itself. But it does mean, what it does mean is that neither book is intended to be used as a stand-alone volume. New Pearl Harbor is no longer self-sufficient for the reasons already mentioned. Besides containing some errors, it is several years out of date, having appeared prior to the publication of the 9/11 Commission report, NIST's report on the Twin Towers, and many other developments. Likewise, New Pearl Harbor Revisited is not intended to be read by itself. As a commentary on New Pearl Harbor, it presupposes that the readers have already studied that earlier volume. Indeed, it consists of chapters paralleling those of New Pearl Harbor, so that readers can turn immediately from a chapter in that book to the updating of that information in the present book. The full title of this present book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up and the Exposé. The New Pearl Harbor dealt with the official count of 9/11 on the one hand, and the 9/11 Truth Commentary's exposé, or community's exposé of that account, as a cover-up of what really happened on the other hand, as they both existed in early 2004. The present volume deals with the official account in the form in which it has existed since the appearance of the 9/11 Commission report, which came out in July of 2004, which offered a radically new explanation of why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted, and the appearance of NIST's report on the Twin Towers, 2005, which provided a new and supposedly definitive account of why they came down. Besides explaining these revisions of the official story, this book also summarizes the 9/11 Truth Movement's ongoing exposé of these revisions as further attempts to cover up the truth about what really occurred on 9/11. An exposé that, thanks to the influx of large numbers of intellectuals and professionals into the movement, is now so compelling as to be virtually undeniable by anyone who will take the time to study it. I'm going to read that again. What he's saying here is that the evidence is so compelling that it is undeniable to anyone who is willing to give it a fair look. And that is certainly the case. Indeed, indeed. So, there we are. That is David Ray Griffin's latest book. I guess it might be, in a way, kind of the Bible of the truth movement, of the research thus far contained. So, well done to David Ray Griffin. If you want to order that book, I know that Faulkner Books in downtown Port Place Mall is a great place to order books. They are an independent bookseller, and John is fully aware of the importance of independent media in our society, as so many of us are. So if you need to order some books, why don't you try a local independent bookseller, as opposed to the box store in the north end of town. So where are we going to go now? It's 46 after. Okay, well, what we're going to do now is I'm going to move on to another audio piece. Again, this is looking at global warming. And again, the debate is not over what is causing global warming. There's a lot of other things, and it's a pretty complex issue. And I'm, well, I'm not saying I'm sitting on the fence, but I haven't collected all my thoughts about this predicament here. However, I am very wary of when our government, you know, uses fear tactics, you know, to say, you know, this environmental catastrophe is absolutely terrible, and, well, you better cough up a tax, as if that's going to fix it. You know, these carbon taxes is a way, to me, it seems, of suggesting that it is the average citizen who is the problem and must be responsible for, you know, changing the way our politicians and corporations work. And, of course, that's not the case. You know, they're switching the responsibility and the blame there. So, you know, recognizing that, I have to say, ooh, okay, well, there must be some problems in there. You know, something certainly seems peculiar. So here we are. Let's take a look at another side of global warming. And this is from a show segment called Give Me a Break. So this runs for about 8 minutes, so I'll be back after that, and here we are, a look at potential global warming causes.
You've heard the reports. The globe is warming, and it's our fault, and the consequences will be terrible. But you should know there is another side to this story, and scientists who've tried to tell it are often threatened, which makes me say, give me a break. The world is heating up fast, and we have ourselves to blame.
Global warming is real, and we humans are almost certainly the cause.
Books warn that the Earth is under fire. A suicidal planet's approaching a boiling point and a toxic burn. Children are frightened.
I worry. My mom worries the water might rise and it might flood the whole town.
We won't be able to survive for long.
And people say since global warming is because of man, it must be fixed by man now.
Some say irreversible consequences are 30 years away.
This ad council, PSA, says ignoring a coming crisis is like putting our kids in front of a train.
That won't affect me.
What are you most worried will happen?
We'll all die.
Are there some people who say this isn't true?
Yes.
Might they be right?
No.
How do you know they're not right?
Well, because the Earth is getting hotter.
Where do you learn this?
I saw the Al Gore video.
And the Oscar goes to An Inconvenient Truth.
The global warming documentary featuring Vice President Al Gore has been seen by millions. People have proclaimed him a prophet, a cultural icon, a conquering hero.
You are a true champion for the cause, Mr. Gore.
And last week, he won a Nobel Peace Prize. The Oscars were followed by other worldwide media events.
You are Liber.
With all this hoopla, it's no surprise that 86% of Americans say global warming is a serious problem.
Global warming is now, by anybody's measure, a crisis.
But is it a crisis? Yes, the globe is warming, but is it really all our fault? And is it true that the debate is over? No. What you think you know may not be so. For example, in An Inconvenient Truth, Gore says if we allow the globe to warm, terrible things will happen. And
sea level worldwide would go up 20 feet.
Yeah, maybe like the height of this building. We'll probably just like drown and we'll die.
This is what would happen to the sea level in Florida. This is what would happen to San Francisco Bay.
Maybe. Maybe in thousands of years, is the IPCC, the group that shared last week's Nobel Prize with the vice president. But in 100 years, the oceans might rise 7 to 24 inches, not 20 feet.
A faster buildup of heat here.
Mr. Gore also talks about melting ice caps.
That's not good for creatures like polar bears.
They show this heart-rending cartoon.
A new scientific study shows that for the first time, they're finding polar bears that have actually drowned.
But I bet you didn't know that polar bears appear to be doing all right. Future warming may hurt them, but right now the World Conservation Union and the U.S. Geological Survey say most populations of polar bears are stable or increasing.
There is one relationship that is far more powerful than all the others.
The most impressive demonstration in Mr. Gore's movie is the big graph of carbon dioxide levels.
Here's what the temperature has been on our Earth. Now, one thing that kind of jumps out at you is, did they ever fit together?
My goodness. I knew that carbon dioxide is thought to amplify temperature increases, but this shows a clear cause and effect. For 600,000 years, when carbon rose, so did temperature. It suggests that carbon levels control temperature. But the real inconvenient truth is that carbon increases came after temperature rose, usually hundreds of years later. Temperature went up first. I wanted to ask Mr. Gore about that and other things, but he wouldn't agree to talk about this. Why should he when he and others say...
The debate's over.
The science is agreed upon.
The debate is over and the science is in.
It's absurd for people to say that sort of thing. It's really wrong.
These scientists are among those who say the debate is by no means over.
Right there.
John Christie and Roy Spencer won NASA's Medal for Exceptional Achievement for figuring out how to get temperature data from satellites. They agree that the Earth is warmed.
We all agree that it's warmed, I think. The big question is, and the thing that we dispute, is it because of mankind?
Climate changes, they point out. It always has, with or without man. Early last century, even without today's big output of carbon dioxide, the Arctic went through a warm period. The media fretted about that then, too. And Greenland's temperatures rose 50% faster in the 1920s than they're rising now. Some scientists say the warming may be caused by changes in the sun, or ocean currents, or changes in cloud cover, or other things we don't understand. The debate is not over. And anyway, who's to say that yesterday's temperature was the perfect one? If temperatures keep rising now, these scientists say we don't know that that will be all bad.
The fact is, when the climate changes, there are gains and there are losses.
But Tim Ball, who studies the history of climate change, points out that all we hear about is the bad news from the IPCC, that massive group of global warming scientists.
2,000 scientists.
2,500 scientists say the globe is getting warmer and we are to blame.
There's the most unmitigated rubbish talked about.
Paul Ryder of the Pasteur Institute and John Christie say they were members of the IPCC. That so-called group of scientists, they say, is not what people think it is.
The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It is governments who nominate people. You'll find in many chapters that there are people who are not scientists at all.
Who are they?
They were essentially activists.
Members of groups like Greenpeace were involved. And when the IPCC report came out, not all its members agreed with what was said.
We were not asked to look at a particular statement and sign our names to it at all.
I got very frustrated and I resigned.
But the IPCC still listed Ryder as part of the so-called consensus.
I contacted the IPCC and said, look, I've resigned. I don't want anything more to do with this. And they said, well, you've been involved, so you're still on the list.
Only when he threatened to sue, he says, did they take his name off the report. The IPCC denies that that happened. Today, scientists like these are often smeared as deniers.
We have Holocaust deniers, we have climate change deniers, and to be honest, I don't think there's a great deal of difference.
Deniers are confusing the issue and delaying solutions.
Often they're accused of being purchased by a well-funded denial machine.
These corporate toadies lying to you and telling you that global warming doesn't exist.
Good morning.
The illusion of a debate has been purchased with millions of dollars a year.
Aren't you guys all on the tape?
I wish I was. I wouldn't be driving a 1992 car and living in a leaky apartment.
These scientists all say they don't get any money from business, yet some have been threatened. One email said, you will not live long enough to see global warming.
And even more direct than that.
We stick our necks out. We do get hurt.
Is this what the global warming debate has come to? One side saying, shut up, dissent must not be heard. The truth is that while everyone agrees the Earth is warmed, lots of good scientists don't agree that it's mostly our fault and don't agree that it's going to be a catastrophe. So when the Nobel Prize winner says,
the debate's over. The debate's over.
I say, give me a break.
Okay, well done. So there we are, a different look at global warming. So there we are. That's just about going to do it for tonight's show. Of course, you've been listening to the Unbought and Unbossed show on CHLY, best radio station in town. I want to thank Jack East, who was the... telephone guest for the first hour with the Marxist-Leninist Party, a political and peace activist. So fantastic to that. And next week, I'm going to have an telephone interview with the tinfoil hat lady, Beata Van Berkum. She's out of Saskatoon, so fantastic. After that, DJ Ball from Vancouver We Are Change, and then Tony Hall, a professor out of Lethbridge who has joined the Truth Movement. So that's some of the upcoming speakers. I'm going to leave us now with the song by Tool, Part of Me. Be well, everyone.